This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tap, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow, a nut, a tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person, just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan and start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Hello and welcome to episode 173, the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today, we welcome Alex Dunham from Hoover. I'm starting to go back, not to my usual place of the late 90s, but the early 90s and late 80s. Like past guests, Guy from Rites of Spring or Ian MacKaye, there's so many bands I didn't see or know about until much later when realizing the connections with this genre and scene. Look out for a bunch more from this time period that are not talked about enough. One of those bands is Hoover. I'd heard about them, many mentioned them to me over the years, and I'd always had them on my short list of people to get on the podcast. Well, Alex Dunham, singer and guitarist for the band, and I connected in New York City right before the pandemic took hold in early March. It is crazy to hear our conversation have zero of the weight of the conversations happening with our friends and family today. A time capsule for what was before this insanity we're all in now. It's also the last time I did an interview in my apartment in New York City. I insanely miss doing interviews in person because there's so much about gauging an answer, a pause, the eye contact, and the laughs. I'm happy someone captured that moment at my shitty IKEA kitchen table. If there's one thing to do during this podcast, it is take a minute. I let Alex contemplate, take a breath about a lot within this podcast. There's so much to get to with his beginnings in Arizona, learning about punk, getting the fuck out of Arizona and heading to DC, getting signed to Discord, and a story about Fugazi staying at his grandmother's house. We also talk about what he's doing right now with his custom furniture company, Broken Press Design. Hoover should be mentioned daily when talking about post-hardcore and the early 90s in this scene. They are absolute icons, and I couldn't have been happier to have Alex on to tell his story. This is episode 173 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Alex Dunham from Hoover. Thank you for being on the podcast.
It's wonderful to be here.
Welcome to New York City.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty serendipitous. I think that's what I was saying to my wife when we were walking over here. Like, all this kind of went down in a week.
Yeah, I love it. You just happen to be here.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
So, quick, because Ian MacKaye reminded me to do this every time, state your name so for pronunciation purposes and for posterity.
It's not Alex. It's Alex Dunham. The date? Do I need the date?
We do need the date.
It's March 1st.
March 1st?
2020. And we're here in your apartment in Hell's Kitchen.
And rent is due.
Rent is due. I'm not helping you with that. I got like 20 bucks.
So I didn't realize that you emailed me years ago. And do you remember what you wrote? Because I couldn't find it in my email. Do you remember what you wrote?
I might have just said, hey, I'm just dropping a note, kind of not into podcasts, but found yours. Been hearing some old pals talking on your thing, and you're doing a good job.
Oh, thank you.
Or whatever, and sign my name. Didn't know if that was going to be like something like, oh, well, shit, do you want to be on or right. not? But not really looking for that. I just kind of had this, I don't know what motivated me, because I normally don't do this, but I might have listened to something that, you know, moved me in a certain way, like a pal talking, and I'm like remembering the days that that pal was talking about, and I wanted to thank you for, you know, it's like somebody seeing a band and going up and being like, I just want to shake your hand and thank, and you know, countless times that happened to me, and I'm like, that's the raddest thing in the world. So, you know, trying to keep doing that to somebody else, you know? I mean, that it's still, that we're still talking about this shit this many years later, it blows my mind.
So that's so weird. Did you, like, starting getting into music, starting playing music, that was in Arizona?
Yeah, you know, Jesus, this goes way back. So I have to give cred here to some old-time Phoenix punkers and that I met at the BMX track, because I raced BMX. Mm-hmm. And Scott Holman and Jimmy Griffiths. They were older dudes than me at the BMX track, but my grandma loved them because she knew them from racing. They ended up taking me to my first shows and stuff, and I was young. But she trusted them because the BMX track was a community. And it's like, whatever, you know. Everybody was high in that car on the show. There's no reason I should be alive. But they were just feeding me records. And that's how, you know, I got started really, really young. You know, I'm getting the Fear record and turning my life around. You know, grow up with my dad, and he was late 60s Detroit, and you know, he liked Stooges and MC5, and you know, he'd yell at me about playing a Black Flag record too loud, and I'm like, same shit, man.
Right.
Like I identified it early, you know. So I'm fortunate that way, because I had a good understanding of like true American punk rock hardcore at an early age. And it just influenced me, but I was not a musician. My dad played guitar, and we had a pretty volatile relationship. And I really didn't want to be anything like him. I'm almost identical to him now, except probably not as much of a freaker biker. But regardless, you know, like, once one of my pals in junior high said we should play music, I'm like, okay, Dad, teach me some chords, you know? So I went to the first rehearsal with other buddies in Arizona, the Wall Brothers and Eric Astor from Furnace Records. That was kind of my, well, it was the band that I did that ended up playing its first show, you know? So that's kind of the first band. And I remember being at practice, and the other guitar player, Jason Peterson, he was like, yeah, so just play it like this. And I'm like, well, what notes are those? And he's like, I don't know. And I'm like, well, I only know chords. And they're like, we don't know chords. And I'm like, well, what do you do? And like, no, you play this thing that's like the bar chord. And I'm like, but you don't know the notes. I'm like, yeah, just watch my hand. And that's how I got started.
Wow. And that was mid-80s?
86, 87, which is literally the craziest time. So, you know, like, I get this introduction of, like, early 80s hardcore and punk from my other friends, and then these guys are onslaughting me with the other records that they know, you know, like late junior high, early, you know, sophomore year of high school, whatever. And they're, you know, I'm getting these Straight Edge records. I'm getting all the, like, year before Discord records. Like, Dag Nasty just came out. Age of Quarrel just came out. Crossovers happened. Like, everything is happening. You know, and you're just sucking it down. You don't even know what to, you're just like, I love it all. And it's all different.
Right.
I mean, there's, it runs the gamut. It's incredible. And you're like, I don't care. I like it all. So, you know, when we've talked here before even starting this about how you got started and really what your main objective is with your podcast. But like, to me, that's just a label or a genre, you know, and everybody wants to do that because they want to categorize stuff. I mean, they need to make sense of it. For me, I didn't care. I didn't need to make sense of shit. I just like, give me right. all of it. English dogs, broken bones, attitude adjustment, fucking GBH, LARM, you know, like mm-hmm. just keep it coming. I just want to hear all of it because you never heard any of this before, you know? Anything like this. I grew up Arizona radio, you right. know? Classic rock, where you hear the same Led Zeppelin song 17 times a day, mm-hmm. you know? And like, I don't need to hear it anymore. I've heard it 400,000 times
right.
in my life. And I like, if I'm on a job site doing an install for my business or whatever, I'll hear that song again. And I'm like, no, this is the reason.
Right.
You check out and you're like, I'm done. I want all the weird shit. Bring yeah. it my way.
And then the first band that's mentioned is Wind of Change.
Yeah,
right?
Wind of Change. People would sometimes say Winds of Change.
I think I did that back. I think I wrote down Winds of
yeah.
twice. So Wind of Change.
Yeah, we did a tour.
A tour.
You know, I played a bunch of shows like, a couple times in California and stuff. But we did a tour in the summer of 89. I just graduated high school. It was a disaster. There was seven of us in this van. It was perfectly American punk rock tour, you know. I think the third day out, our wheel bearing froze and we lost an axle in Gothenburg, Nebraska. Almost got in a fucking gang war with the locals. And then a tornado hit the town that night. You know, like it was a Sunday. Like the dealership wasn't open to get our van fixed or whatever. But yeah, I wouldn't trade any of that summer for the world. We played CBGBs that year. Or yeah, that summer. We played The Rat. Oh my God. We played with some killer band. We played with Blast at CBGBs.
Wow.
And Kevin Seconds was in the crowd. Like, American Standard played. This is ridiculous.
Right.
This is like, so, I'm 18 years old.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, this is how it works?
Is this how it's supposed to be? Yeah.
Okay. Just awesome.
Well, I think you mentioned sort of the labeling. I had always thought when I was thinking about emo or even just, it was like, I was into hardcore. I was into metal first. Then hardcore, sure. then post-hardcore, and then I found this. But it all sort of connected, because when you saw a certain screamo band, real screamo or actual screamo, you know, you could tell that they were into hardcore, or they played with a hardcore band, sure. or they were playing with...
We all loved the same shit.
It just happened to be different sounds throughout the night, right. and it wasn't like it needed to all be chugga-chugga.
Yeah. Well, Phoenix had a rad scene, because, you know, California bands were always... split. I mean, it's still 6 hours, but
it's on the way to Texas.
Yeah,
it's right. on the way back.
So we saw so many bands, and you know, there you gotta stop through Phoenix to get to LA
right.
from the East or the Midwest. So, I mean, but on any given night, you would have like Saint Vitus with Husker Du. You know, like what? Who books that show?
Right.
But you're Phoenix, and you need to have, you know, you're not, those bands are like, we're in town.
Right.
Okay, jump on this bill. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It's not the hardcore. It's not the emo. It's not, you know,
punk, whatever.
You know, it's not that show. It's bands that aren't on the radio show at this club, which everybody goes to every single night.
Right, it's a good way of putting it. I don't want to hear what's on the radio. That's how I felt. I felt when I found the college radio station back home. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, what is this sound?
Yeah.
It's not the same. songs or 10 songs.
But it also really depended. I mean, I learned this too, like going out to the East Coast early on. It's like really getting in. I'm a huge fan of the history of radio. And then finding these, we didn't have a lot of those independent college radio stations. We had, like, NPR was right. The only thing in Phoenix. Once I got East Coast, you got all these college towns. And you know, it's like, yeah, you tune in, but...
It's for 2 hours.
It depended on who was playing, you know, or what you were doing. I did a little thing with, like, Greg Foreman in State College, Pennsylvania, for like a couple days. He had a little gig, and we turned it into a shit show, but you know, we thought it was funny, but whatever. But I mean, you know, who's listening? Whatever, you know, you might be changing a mind. Or
I had it where these, I found out these high school kids were listening to my college station in North Carolina, because they would call in and they would be like, what was that? And I was like, oh, it's this band, and they're like playing
but
on Friday.
You're supposed to say after you play the song.
What do you mean?
That, and
oh,
before
yeah, yeah,
that,
yeah, no.
and
back
before
sell,
that,
front sale, yeah,
and before
yeah, yeah.
That,
no, I'm saying, but
that.
they were like they had forgotten or came in halfway through, or I front selled it and didn't back sell it. But they, I remember one point I picked them up to like go to a show, and I'm like,
cool.
That doesn't happen now. Like I think I'd be like picked up by someone else in a van and put in the slammer, but like they were like, come pick us up, we're gonna go to this show, and
that's
their
awesome.
Parents, and I was the college kid at the radio station, but it was that same. Like, they needed to hear it, and I happened to only be on for 2 hours on a Saturday or a Sunday, but they knew.
Right.
So it's that discovery part when you hear it.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing thing. But again, you know, like anything, everything evolves. So now it's the podcast, and this is what teaches somebody if they fall onto it. But it's just, I like, you know, I romanticize radio so much. Like, I grew up listening to Ernie Harwell on the AM waves for the Tiger games, and there was nothing like that sound, you know, driving in the car.
Right.
There's no FM, and, you know, you're in a 66 whatever Biscayne or whatever. But
I have a love affair with it as well. There's a parking lot that my mom would go to the grocery store, and it was high up in Vermont, and my dad and I would sit in the car, and we could pick up FAN in New York.
Oh, nice.
We could pick up 660. Sometimes we could pick up, what's the news station in Chicago? It's not
WGN?
No, it wouldn't be it wasn't WGN. I'll think WTOP.
Oh, okay.
We could pick up that.
Wow.
And we could pick up 880 down here, WCBS. But we would just sit there, and you know, it'd fade in and out.
Yeah. You're not even doing your like shortwave radio thing.
No, this is just AM. Yeah.
Right.
But you were outside of your bubble, outside of where you were, and realizing there was something else. Because at a young age, you don't realize that sometimes. You need that reminder.
That's, you know, so we're talking about this radio geekness. It's pretty much what Electrolux is about. The song.
Is it?
Hoover. Yeah. I mean, it's all about me. I wrote the words to that driving my Ford Motorcraft parts delivery through. So I worked for a distribution company that dealt in Ford Motorcraft parts, and we delivered to a bunch of dealers. But on Monday mornings, I would do a 5-state radius out of Bailey's Crossroads, Virginia. So I'd be all the way up into West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and coming back down through what's that town? What's Patsy Cline's town? Winchester. And Route 7 was a main route coming back into Bailey's Crossroads 2. And I got hit by a dump truck one day, and then that rehearsed later that night.
Really?
Route 7. So there's a lot of stuff that came out of my like route for that job. It was so funny. But, you know, just all I had was the radio.
Right.
And just trying to find, you know, I'd be like, you know, never on the FM dial, just pop songs or whatever.
Right.
But I'd be just up and down the AM dial wherever I was, and you get the small station, and I would know, I'd dial in because of, like, for this 50 miles.
Yeah.
I had this weird evangelical or evangelical station, you know, and the guy's voice was crazy, you know, but it's like, I don't want to listen to the content, but I want to hear this guy's voice because it's crazy. But
yeah, you're it's that sense of discovery, the curiosity.
Yeah. I mean, it's just anything just to keep your
mind off.
Yeah.
Whatever garbage.
Well, or sharp, you know, cause you're actively, you know, I mean, maybe it's a distraction because you're looking for it and you're not driving.
Right.
But I'm driving, but I didn't have a cell phone.
Yeah. So when did you, so did you move to DC for work? For
no, I, so I thought about this line of question too. you know, we're really active in the scene in Arizona, and, you know, after the old timers kind of stopped doing stuff, the young kids kind of took over, and, you know, everything's changing. You know, from, like we were saying before, 85 to 86, 86 to 87, like night and day. It's like a millennial. But, you know, old guys dropped out, got married, whatever. We started doing the shows. So Fugazi was starting to come around. So we would do the shows. And Fugazi would stay at my house with me and my grandma. So funny, because I remember, like, back in this era, they had Joey, their roadie. He was great. He was the, I've got to find out where he is. But he was just Joey. He was rad. He loved my grandma so much.
Aww.
And then, you know, she would be like, what can I make you guys? And, you know, half of them are, like, fucking vegan.
Right.
Was, like, fucking French-Canadian from 1924, you know? So she's, like, meat and potatoes. That's it, you know?
Poutine.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. She never made poutine ever. Weird. I had to discover that on my own. But, yeah, so those guys were hanging out, and I think it was... I know it was Ian... I don't know if it was Guy or Brendan, but both of them were, like, saying to me, you know, I'm, like, 18, 19 maybe, 20. And they're both like, hey, you know, hey, you guys do a good job out here. We really support people supporting their scenes, and we really advocate people doing the good things for their scene, but you got to get out of here. Come to DC, man. We'll set you up. Like, you know, somebody will put you up to crash or whatever. And I was already, I had done a couple, yeah, I was 20. So I had done a couple years at community college, and all the people in the program, I was really into photography and printmaking. So I was taking all these courses, the community college. I was doing some of the prerequisite, you know,
like
whatever you need for
English,
college.
Math,
yeah.
Right.
But I was also taking printmaking classes and photography classes. And the people in that department I met were all grads of San Francisco Art Institute. And they're like, you should apply. And my uncle lived up there. So I was all set to go. I think I had a grant even on the table. And then in the back of my head, was Mr. Mackay saying, get the fuck out of here. Come over here. So I just said, okay. And so I knew Joe. I didn't know Fred, but I knew Joe from a tour he had came through with Admiral.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed at our house. I think the other band was Separate Piece. So I met all these great guys, and I think I met him on the tour before. That's how, when we play like Pittsburgh or Harrisburg or something. But so he was already living there. So I went, crashed a couple nights at the Pirate House in D.C. Brendan was living there. I got to meet Bert Kieres. And I told him, like, man, I wrote you a letter for the Grey Matter Food for Thought record, you know? He's like, I don't remember, but cool, hey. And it was like the first and last time I saw him.
Wow.
My entire time in D.C. It was hilarious.
Wow.
But, that was that first night. And yeah, so then I just basically kind of moved into Joe's room after that. And then they were in a band playing, and then they would be done practicing, and then I would play my guitar really loud. Kind of weird.
Right.
Like, hey, I'm right here. And then finally somebody's like, hey, you want to play with us? So that's how we started.
Wow. That's how it started.
Yeah.
And I think this is an interesting time because it's like the Fugazi and those bands were already doing mm-hmm. it. And it was, I think, it was like a middle period almost. Like there was like that moment of Fugazi and then these kind of bands after it. And you were just starting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if it's house shows, I think it was really experimental. Did it feel that way? Did it feel like...
Honestly, you know, I've listened to other podcasts of yours and stuff, and I hear people say this, like, and maybe because it's been said so many times, but you're not thinking that way. You have no, like, outside yourself to look back at it at in the moment. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's no third point, third perspective or whatever. I just wanted to play, you know? So... that's what we did,
right?
And yeah, so much shit was happening. I mean,
what was some of the, I mean, this is the, it was funny, I was thinking about this with a friend. I was like, if there's a cliche question, it's influences, but I think this one makes sense a lot because no one sounded like Hoover.
Yeah, but other people would argue that
but no one sounded like Slint in 92. And I think what were the counterparts or what were those bands that did that? And yes, people can have opinion, but I'm saying this is from someone just after looking back and realizing that in that epicenter, there was that happening. So were there, those initial ones?
I think when, you know, like that's a loaded question. I mean, I could talk for 4 hours about that question alone. But I think the simplest way, I don't know about anybody else, but us four in Hoover, we weren't listening to a lot of hardcore at that point. I mean, we were going to shows and we were seeing the bands in our
scene
and the people that would come through,
right?
You know, and we had friends, and when we play shows, we're listening to the bands, we're being respectful, but like actively, you know, hey, I'm gonna drive my car and put in a cassette. That cassette wasn't a hardcore band. That cassette was anything from cool jazz to fucking talk to West African guitar players to blue, you know, what? For myself, I think by that point, when we were fully playing all the time and just inundated with that, I needed to escape. My thought was, if I'm not actively listening to all these bands, then I'm not going to sound like them. And that became a really big thing for me. I really didn't want to be lifting. I think early on in the Hoover thing, we were getting a lot of Fugazi comparisons, and that bummed me out because I didn't want to copy them.
Right.
I didn't want to disrespect them by copying them. Not that I wanted to copy them to be on their coattails or whatever. Right. I wanted to not disrespect them.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big, big thing for me at 22. 22 years old.
That's great, though. I mean, to have the... I think you talked earlier about not having the perspective. I think having that perspective then, when a lot of times that was it. Oh, what's happening now? How do I keep going? But yeah, no, but this was, let me look at something different and add it to this sound. Because I think from...
I mean, you're always influenced by something. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you go to a house party and Fugazi's playing a bunch of new material to only friends, you know? And you're there and you're like, holy shit. And then you're practicing the next day and you're influenced by it because it was so hot and fresh, you know, or, you know, so-and-so just came through and you saw him that night, and then you had a rehearsal the next day. Or you didn't have a rehearsal the next day, but you were playing in your room.
Right.
And it's going to come out. I mean, everybody's influenced by something. You know, like, you hang out in Scotland enough, you're going to start talking like that.
No, I was in London for just a week, and by Thursday, my emails were starting to use the mannerisms of like the Brits. Like, I was like kicking myself. I'm like, stop doing that. You know, don't stop saying right before you start.
It's assimilation, though. You know, I mean, it happens. It's a natural progression.
So those bands playing in that early '90s, like having the Discord connection. How did that come about? Was that just, again, they heard you guys were doing stuff and said, let's put out a single, let's put out a 7-inch?
I think Ian approached us. He's like, you guys are rad. And, you know, we had known each other. He had known all of us from our different states, you know? Like, maybe he didn't even know Chris, who was in his own state, you know?
Right. Or
in Maryland, right there. But, you know, we all had a... some semblance of, you know, relationship. So when we were playing together, I think it was probably like our fifth show, like St. Stephen's Basement, which was such a rad spot to play.
Was that DC?
Yeah, it was right on 16th at Monroe, I think. Anyway, the basement shows were so great. Upstairs, I didn't care for. We played upstairs once, but downstairs was great. Anyway, because you're on the floor with everybody.
Right.
You're not on a big stage. And that's how I always loved it. There was once a show in Evanston and outside of Chicago that Hoover played in. I think the Scissor Girls played and somebody else. I can't remember, but there was a stage set up. It was a concrete room. It sounded like shit. And we're like, can we play over here in the corner on the floor? And they're like, well, we got to move some of the stuff. And I'm like, we'll just play. We just need a vocal. Right. Vocal mic. You know, whatever. Run it through the same PA. Just bring the long cord. Just so everybody could be around us, you know? And it ended up sounding that much better. But, downstairs. So, St. Stephen's. And I think we finished the show, and Ian came up, and he's like, hey, that was great. Let's go to the inner ear.
Wow.
Let's make a record.
Wow.
Let's do a couple songs, something like that. And it was a split record, but, you know, they financed it. But it wasn't it was a half Discord release. And then, that was a three song.
Hoover Union / Discord, right?
Yeah.
In 92.
Yeah.
Sidecar Freddy / Cable.
Right. Fun songs.
How did you pick those?
I think it was our newest material.
Yeah, always, right? Like, well, these are our best songs.
So I got to backtrack. So, you know, I get in the band, and those guys already had like 8 songs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we wrote one together, which was the split with Lincoln.
Right.
Two Down. That was the first song that we wrote with me in the band.
Two-Headed Coin.
Yeah. And those guys are like, just keep doing more of this. And we didn't ever record any of those other songs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah, because we found, like, to get, I mean, whatever. I'm not taking credit for this. It's just a new person in the band.
Yeah,
and, you know, and then I was like, oh, shit, now we're here? Okay. Let's continue to be here. Let's keep going here.
Right.
And, but, you know, we played 2 shows with that other set. It's funny because I never knew any of the song names. I remember writing my own set list, like, because we after this early era, we never wrote a set list again. We would always just verbally say, hey, let's go this and this, and we never played the same set because fuck that.
Right.
fuck that. And I'm not trying to diss any of my friends that do that. And I know, like, especially older, and you're just, you need to be,
right.
You need to have that routine for your psychosis or whatever.
Or the but guitar tech to give you the next right, guitar.
Right. But fuck that. Never, I would never, ever, ever do that. So basically, my whole tenure with playing music would always be like, hey, let's play about four songs or whatever. And then just ad hoc. Because you got to feel what's going on in front of you.
Yeah, front.
And, you know, like, skipping ahead when I was in regular watch, we had like 40 songs. We could play 40 songs any given night.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two separate feeling sets. And that was totally predicated on what was going on in the crowd.
Right, if they're feeling the slower things or the quieter things, you go in that realm.
We played at Fireside one night after Lounge Acts the night previous, and we were opening for Thornetta Davis, the Big Chief band, right. I think, backed her. I'm like, we can't fucking play this balls-out hardcore shit. That's going to ruin... Like, who are these... Right. I mean, half the people there see us, but... Or not half, maybe a third.
Right.
And the two-thirds is there for Thornetta Davis. And just out of respect for her, we were like, we're just going to play our weird set, you know? Slow and moody and whatever, and get it... Warm them up for her, you know? Like a true... opening act should do. I mean, that doesn't exist in the hardcore world. You know, nobody's thinking that way.
Right.
That night we thought that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just thought.
I mean, not
that's growing. That's maturing in the scene and shit, or not the scene, but as a musician.
Right. You know? I mean, then playing those songs initially, those newer ones when you started playing and. What was the response? What did you feel? Like, did you feel?
Oh, yeah. It took off. Yeah. There was so much electricity. Like.
Because we don't have the endorphins by a phone or things or email. It right. was, what was it? Just you go to
pure,
the.
Pure. Just, whoa, what is going on? And everything's on the table. Like, wow. If I'm not playing. I'm playing through my equipment. I'm not playing. It's the sound that's coming out. Like, it just sonically, and the chemistry in that band was outrageous. I mean, I've played with some good players, and I've been happy to write some good songs. That move, you know, I'm really critical about something being done or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm like, hey man, if I'm not moving my legs or my feet in practice, then this song's not going to be heard by anybody else. Because why should there be one that just sucks right. just to fill up the time or the space on the record or whatever?
I just always felt I needed to be tapping my leg when I played in a band. I needed to make, if I stopped, that's meant that that part wasn't good.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of wonderful, wonderful people out there. And then, you know, you're like, wow, I really like this artist, but how did that one get through, you know?
Right.
It's just like, you know, maybe they're not self-editing as hard as they should.
Yeah. So you said the response was great. What were things that you guys were responding to or answering? Was it this tour or making more music or
I just think the time was about like all I think all four of us were just consumed with making music. It was what you want to do. It's like a drug addict wanting to do their drug, you know. We did that, and incessantly, and our rehearsals, they weren't structured whatsoever. I mean, they were like, sounds silly, but jams. But we wouldn't communicate. And then we would play for like an hour and a half, and we'd mutate, all of us. We might break and be like, that was great. Let's do this 5-4 thing here and whatever, you know. But it was the most natural thing I've ever been a part of, you know, like it's pretty natural with my wife, but that takes work. Hoover did not.
Right. I think when you mentioned at the jam, when I was re-listening to a bunch of the songs, I thought Breathe or Resist felt like a jam blues-like.
That came out of just Joe opening up one day in the, it was a attached garage to our row house. He just started playing that riff. And that song fell into itself pretty much that way.
Right.
Just no words, just went. I mean, I've been at some rehearsals where, you know, after Hoover, I desperately wanted to play. I was like the first one to be rehearsing with all kinds of, I think it was even playing with Cret Wilson and Jason Farrell at one point too, like, and then but yeah, like I was the last one to actually play a show after.
Oh, after Hoover.
Yeah. Even though I was the first one to be, like, immediately playing, you know?
Right.
But, yeah, everything else was a lot of work. I mean, not a lot of work, but it just came so easy.
Right.
With us.
Can you talk about Electrolux? I thought, who decided on the horn?
Fred had played horn, pretty sure, like, through high school or whatever, and hadn't really thought about doing it. I had played saxophone and clarinet, like, in grade school, and there was a show. We were just doing weird shit, so there was a show where I was like, I'm just going to bring... I bought, like, a $3 thrift store clarinet once, and I think I even used the reed that was on it.
Yeah.
Today, that might not be so good, but right. I just brought it to the show, and I'm like, I haven't even played it, and, you know, whatever, we were being weird kids, right. So, like, I think halfway through the show, I might have played, I don't even think I played it, but it was just sitting by my amp, just to be, and I think Fred was like, yeah, man, well, I used to play horn, and why can't I do that, why wouldn't I do that,
right. You know?
Nobody's playing horn in a hardcore band. Let's do it, you know? And I, really, it might even been Jeff Turner, because he plays piano on Cable, when we redid Cable on the record. So, yeah, he might have been like, yeah, let's get some other instruments going on. So, you know, it was just one of those things, like, whatever, do something, anything to, if it don't work, it don't work, you know,
but try it.
Anything right. To be like, oh, it's not guitar, bass, and drums.
Right.
And fast forward to Abilene, and it's like, what?
Did you think that you influenced, you know, Gravity Records or the Midwest scene with that?
I cannot speak to that.
Because that's the sort of, we talked about that earlier. You said I had this sort of like break where you weren't paying attention, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about Gravity, surprisingly. Probably that's a San Diego label.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we played with Heroin once, but I think it was like our second show. And we played down in San Diego too at the Che Cafe.
Yeah.
That was a great show. But yeah, I don't know enough to make.
All right. How about I ask it this way? When did you realize people were mentioning Hoover? How long after the band was over that people kept bringing it up or kept saying?
Well, to this day, it's crazy. And then so through my business, I'll get emails through my business. Old timers, you know, like, I never saw you, or I saw you once, and your furniture's great, but I gotta tell you the story, you know, and just like how much they loved or how much influence I had. And it's,
when did that start? When did you start getting those?
Well, through social media stuff, I would be getting that stuff from, you know, whatever, 10 years ago. But, yeah, last few years it's been through the business, actually.
Cause, wow.
You know, I guess people search your name and then they find your website.
Right.
And it's, so I have this funny thing because I have this employee who's like, yeah, whatever, you play music. And I'm like, yeah I did. And then anytime one of these emails comes, I just print it out.
There you go, buddy.
I print it out and I hand it to him. And, you know, I mean, it's wonderful. Obviously, it doesn't go to my head. It's just, but it's so flattering for people to still have a passion about it, you know? I mean, I do. I go in the shop and I'll play a record from 81, you know, and I'm like dancing around my shop before the guys get there, you know, and I still love it. You know, yeah. Some things don't hold up as much when you go back to them,
right.
But, you know, there are those special records, you know.
I think, too, that's what I thought was amazing, that people kept mentioning it. And, I mean, I didn't see you back then. I was still middle school. Like, I wasn't cool.
Oh,
I
what's your age?
I'm 41.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah, it's not too far removed.
Right. It's just, just a little, missed it.
Yeah, right.
And I think I did see some bands immediately, if it was, like, 400 Years or Policy of Three or... God.
Playing with all those guys.
Right, like those, that, mm-hmm. Right, would have been in line and just, you know, again, from not having the internet or being have to read in a zine or find it on the back of a CD, right. Or whatever those things were, I think that's what was exciting about it. And to have it still be mentioned, and I think bands, even newer bands today, still mention it. And
yeah.
And again, to have Ian sort of say, like, come on out and do this.
Yeah.
Like, that was a great thing that he said.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely took a better direction in my life. I mean, I could have been still wasting away in Arizona.
Right.
Know, for all I know.
Did you?
A lot of people there that just never left.
They're right.
Just, and, the, you know, the thing is, like, if you left there, you could always go back. It was easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an easy life there. So it's like, why aren't you guys making the jump? Try.
Right. Right.
You know, so
what about,
I just never look back.
Yeah. What about the association with the word emo? When did you guys hear it back then?
I mean, I think we were aware of it already, you know, when we were playing. I mean, I think it was being thrown around. And to me, you know, like I was saying with 85, 86, 87, there was so much different stuff going on in hardcore. Everything, like, it was probably one of the most diverse times, in my opinion, but I haven't really fully like microscoped it since, but I mean over the last 20 years or whatever.
Right.
But you know, I didn't care, like I said, I just give it all to me. But yeah, we're fully aware of the term. Obviously, and I don't think anybody would really own saying that they were trying to go for a sound. We weren't going for a sound. We were getting in a room and playing. And, you know, at one point I think somebody had said, we heard somebody say it, like, what the fuck, what music isn't emotional, you know? But I think a big thing about it is, that, like, when you're singing about personal stuff and not politics or crushing beers or crushing skulls,
right,
that makes it emo because you're looking inward and not outward. I listened recently to your podcast with Guy, and I was just really taken with how he was kind of talking about it on the three.
I know, he actually prepared for the interview. It was unbelievable. Yeah, he was so sweet. No, it was, he.
Well,
he,
I kind of did too, because I was listening. I know,
yeah, but he knew I was going to ask him.
Right, right, right. So with that, I'm like, yeah, I almost feel the same way, except I'm a little later than him. So, like, my first thing is, like, what the fuck is that shit? No, that's not my thing. It's like, I know what that shit is, but that's not, whatever. And then there's the middle period. It's like, what the fuck happened?
Right.
That was the main thing. Like, you know, you're talking about the mainstream sort of stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to be associated with this thing. I mean, you know, people would say it to us, and we're like, sure. Okay. If that's how you need to do it, then do that. But yeah, of course we're emotional.
Right.
Everybody is. Unless you have some kind of disability of social interaction, you know, or whatever. But then that third thing that Guy was talking about, I hadn't even really thought that hard about it. But it's a thing. I mean, and that's wonderful.
What did it connect? Meaning that it always changes and it's always morphing? Is that was his
right? No. Part? That just that people are using that term
as they're
being, you know, outcasts or, you know, it's like, this is our community. Whatever, if there's bands doing it or not or whatever, this is just a people thing. You know, like, this is, hey, I'm a skinny, androgynous whatever. Is that the term now? I don't even know. But I'm so old that I don't know the current terms.
I understand what you mean.
But, you know, there's a person in, like, Argentina who's, like, got purple hair, and they're identifying with this scene because it gives them comfort because they're being ostracized by their society, you know? I love that. I love that that's a thing for people to go to. You know, and if I'm in a lineage of that, sign me up.
Right.
I'll put my signature on it immediately. Let's go.
Because that's the same thing of you guys playing. It's like, we're going to try this. We're going to do this. There's no, you know, outside influence.
Always,
it's not.
Always forward. You know, all the influences, none of the influence, whatever comes out.
So over the years, when you were listed on those, if it was the top tens or, you know, 100 this or...
Who knows?
do you think it had something to do with... I think Discord, yes, the music itself would have lived, but I think also there are labels that come and go, you know? If it's, you know, Art Monk, still not around, but, like, I think that plays into... Discord does such a good job with having everything organized and online or wherever, whatever form it was. Yeah. And I feel like that keeps it alive. And that's a huge part of it.
Sure. I also think that, you know, newer, hotter bands, like the people that are true to their craft, know what got them there, you know? So I think that even the younger people that are looking at those bands are like, wow, whatever you say is going to be gold. And they're like, well, here, you got to go back to here.
Right.
You know? And if you're on that list, you're on that list. If you're not, you're not. You know, whatever. And there's so many different lists by so many different bands. But if a band just takes it all for themselves and they're not giving back to how they got there, I think that's a disservice. And I also think that it's just not true, maybe, is the word. But I believe, I mean, you know, we didn't make all that shit up on our own. We had songs streaming through our heads that made us play a certain chord or a certain, you know, discordant chord at a certain time or played in weird time structures.
Syncopated rhythms.
Yeah, you know, that didn't just come out of our ass.
Right.
It came from somebody else.
Can you talk about, I thought another song when I was listening back was Weeds. I just thought it was beyond heavy. That's what I wrote down.
Yeah, that was a mean, mean mother.
It was dark.
That's my favorite song.
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
And it's mean. And it was fun to play. Yeah, that's when I started playing a lot of, like, open F tunings. That's a fun song to play. And just doing false harmonics. It was just fun.
Right.
You know, it felt like I was in Quiet Riot or something.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I love, like, I love melodic and soft, dark. I've always loved the dark stuff, but heavy, heavy, heavy stuff. I mean, I love metal. I've never played in a metal band, but I'm going back to 85, 86, crossover era. I mean, I listen to everything.
Right.
I mean, give me more. And I think I have an affinity or a sort of secret love for that era, not just because I was getting introduced to so much stuff, but this is when the metal kids at high school stopped fucking with me and thought I was cool.
Right.
It's like, you've been a punk for a long time. You just kick your ass. Now, hey, can we tape trade?
Right.
Sure. You're not going to beat me up, right?
Right.
Anyway, yeah, Weeds is great, and Fred did. Fred was awesome. Like we had a. I mean, I do have to mention, like, Jeff Turner was the raddest guy to work with, and I miss that. He was like the fifth member, or fourth member when it came to Watts or whatever. Mm-hmm. But he was brilliant, and the Watts record. That LP is probably sonically the most indicative to what I thought we sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, studio and live, it's always different. I don't know, people tried to get those to be the same thing, but it can never happen. But my guitar sound on that Watts LP is by far the best I think it's ever been captured.
Wow.
But back to Weeds, Fred was doing a vocal take, and we had a mic in like a 55-gallon drum on its side. So when the break happens, he's like rolling the drum.
Wow.
Like, just, we would do this shit all the time, like just little. Most of our live shows, we didn't have hard counts on certain songs and stuff, so we could be a little bit improvised.
Come in and out.
Yeah, whatever. Vocal cue to bring everything back, you know, whatever. Again, based on what the crowd reaction was. So we would play to whatever was happening that day.
Right. Another one, too. I mean, you had a band titled this, too, but I thought Regulator Watts having that, like, syncopated rhythms during it made it really stand out.
Yeah, that was a fun song, too. That was written down where I'm staying right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was me on a like 30-hour caffeine bender walking around the Lower East Side in 92. it's everything I saw that day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Then I think the makes sense to bring up some of the lyrics, because I think when I've talked to other people about them, it felt cryptic. But were there any, you talked earlier about that they were, you know, it wasn't about chugging beers or mm-hmm. breaking necks,
right.
or cracking skulls rather. Can you talk about the lyrics?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like poetry, whatever, you know, it is cryptic. I mean, sometimes some of these songs, they were just written as music, and then we would look at each other like, who wants this one, you know, like who's feeling that they could
put something,
yeah, like get in here, you know,
right,
who feels they have the right cadence for this, you know, or is this in your register? Nah, we didn't.
I know what you mean, said.
But you know, and sometimes be like, no, I got this one, then you know, here's the riff and I got it all in my head, so.
Right.
And but a lot of times for me too, like, I wouldn't actively write down ideas or sentences that I felt that would phonetically come out of my mouth in a good way,
mm-hmm.
but also could be metered to maybe that tune. Yeah, I mean, we're all pretty shy about that, you know, like we never even discussed with each other like what something was about. And you know, you have three different singers in a band, it's like, how do you keep track of everything, you know. Like,
so oh, everyone did lyrics. Song.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like for me, really, it could have been like I wrote a bunch of stuff down during a week while driving around on my job. And it's all these fragmented things. And then it's like, holy shit, let's just put all these together. Right. And they didn't even. And then all of a sudden, it made sense. You know, it had its own topic, even though it was vague and cryptic or whatever, and it was just these good sounding sentences, and then it's like, holy shit, this is what this means. So it's mm-hmm. almost like a subconscious topic, you know, right. like you've been thinking about this, but you didn't know it, but you've been jotting this stuff down, and now it's all come together, and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if many people buy that, but I do.
So the I think you did a bunch of music after Hoover, though.
Yeah,
right
away too, and it just didn't take hold. And but yeah, I guess the next touring band was Regular Watts, but before that, Regular Watts was me and the bassist Kret with Erica Casebolt from Circus Lupus, and we were called Mercurochrome, and we played a handful of shows. Probably only wrote like 6 or 7 songs or whatever, but it was great. And then she was like, I'm leaving town, moving to Baltimore, and she had some stuff going on, so we're bummed. But then we met Arif. Actually, Ryan Rapsis from UFOne came out to DC because I'd met him doing a project called Radio Flyer with the Gage guys, or two of the Gage guys, but he came out, and that was a wicked rehearsal, man. That would have been an incredible thing. But yeah, Arif was just amazing too.
UFOne is, if people haven't dived into them, I always kind of throw them out, like,
yeah, well, it's him.
Yeah, I know, but just the band, just yeah. the name itself, like, take a Saturday and just like sit
yeah.
for a minute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I made some. Once I got to Chicago, I think I stayed over at his house one night, and we did some like 4-track shit, and it was fun. We were always trying to get together and make something happen. He's a beautiful human too. I love him. But yeah, so Watts was a funny time for me because I was bitter. I was bitter because everybody was talking about Hoover on our tour, and I was not a nice guy during those years. Drinking way too much.
What years was that?
Like 96 through the end of
98.
Mm-hmm. We were in Chicago one night, and my girlfriend, who ended up becoming my wife, my first wife, she lived in Chicago, so we'd always stay with her. And, you know, we played the bottle, and or empty bottle, and it was a rad night, and one of the guys was dating somebody there, too, and they're like, let's move to Chicago. And I'm like, stop saying this, because you guys are having a fun night.
Right.
And it's easy to say this shit. Don't say it to me. Like, if you want to move to Chicago, bring it up to me when we're home.
Right.
And you're, you know, it's Wednesday,
yeah.
and we're at rehearsal,
right.
and you're in your life, you know? And they did. They're like, hey, we're really thinking we want to move to Chicago. I'm like, okay, let me think about it. I need a month, because I had 2 jobs that I loved, and I've been in DC forever,
right.
and I don't want to leave. But I didn't want to break the band either. But I wanted to change, you know? So I'm like, I came back, you know, 4 weeks later, and I'm like, yeah, let's move to Chicago. And I'm like, cool. And I'm like, but at the end of the year, you know, like, wrap up, I'm giving 6 months notice to both of my jobs, Dante, Fernando, Black Cat. I worked there. He had been so wonderful to me. I just wanted to give him all the notice in the world. And then I had another boss that was a sweetheart. So I just just want to do right by them, right. You know. And then, you know, 2 months out from the end of the year, those guys are like, yeah, you know, the one dude broke up with the girl. And they're like, yeah, I'm not really feeling moving anymore. And I'm like, I already made my decision. You know,
right.
Everything's in motion for me. Like,
right.
This is the last thing I want to happen, but you guys did this. So that's how I got to Chicago without a band.
Without a band?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't move. So we played our last show like, I don't know, sometime in December or whatever. But it was good. We had a good run. It was a great band. Such a great, that's one of the most proudest records of mine. I look at the one I gave you today.
Yes. What's the name of it again?
Aesthetics of No Drag. The songs, I love the sounds. I love that record. And I remember playing those songs. Now it's a mean record. Like, there's some mean songs. And I love that. But I was also not, like, again, not in a good spot.
Not in those good years. Spot.
But yeah, then I moved to Chicago and fully took two steps back and actually was in a band that lasted longer than 2 years.
Abilene, right?
Yes, yes.
And you were working too. This, what kind of stuff did you find when you got there?
How do you mean?
For jobs.
Oh, somebody, a friend of a friend, was like, I know this old punk rock guy in a band called the Geezers, and he's a carpenter, so you could probably hook up with him. And my dad was a framer, mechanic before Detroit died, and then went west for the like 80s California boom. Building boom, but I was handy enough. I would build like all the lofts for all the bands in DC and their vans. So I was competent enough, but I worked for that guy for like 2 years, and I'm like, I'm not working for anybody ever again. I'm gonna just work for myself. So I've been doing carpentry and / furniture making for since 98.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, a couple reunions here and there with the Hoover shit. And
97 was one, right?
97, just,
oh, no,
for the
record.
No, you
just did an album. Just for the right, record. Right, right. But 2004.
Yeah, but 97 was just because Juan was like, from Slow Dime, wanted to, you know, we hadn't recorded our last four songs. Three? Is that five? Yeah, four songs. So he's like, we got documentation, you know? So we went in and did that again with Turner, Jeff Turner. That was a great session too. But yeah, 04, I don't know how that really came about. It was a blast. Probably the best shows we've ever played. Not maybe performance-wise, it doesn't matter. They're probably equal. But we got paid. Not much, but it was a proper tour.
Proper,
you know,
tour.
We like, right. We got paid for our flights. We got fed those nights. We didn't have to pay for our own beer. You know,
right.
Like that was wonderful. Didn't come home fully broke, but still didn't make any money for the time that I was gone.
Right.
So, in my mind, that's a success.
That feels like a good cap to
yeah.
it. Right.
Yeah. And 08 was great just because it was the big fest, and then we played the Underground again in London. Or what's it? Underworld? In Camden?
Underworld.
Yeah.
They'll yell at us while they're listening. It's fine.
Yeah. And that show was absolutely fabulous, and just lots of old friends, and yeah. But I think we did a couple after 04 in the States. I think we were playing DC, and it was a huge snowstorm that night, and but still packed, you know. But a lot of people didn't make it down because they turned down the turnpike that,
oh wow,
that night. So there's a lot of Jersey kids coming down or whatever, or guys, not kids anymore.
I still say kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if there are guys, they're guys. back in the day, they were the kids.
Yes.
But Yeah, so we did another show in Baltimore to kind of like be like, hey, we're playing again for right. you guys who couldn't make it, you know, and like hardly anybody came. It was a weird night. I think it was 04. It was right after
okay,
that
so 04,
tour.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we played, I think, Mac Rock.
Yep.
With, I think, Sun-O played.
I have all the flyers over there, or books from it. We'll go find your name, because I should have done that before. But, yeah, that seems like a perfect spot to play.
Right. And that was pretty good. But we felt a little disconnected. I remember feeling that way. I'm like...
That was, again, those years is when it did start to just, there was a almost like a amnesia for what was before.
Right.
And it was timing for people with jobs or kids or sure. to graduate, whatever. You know, those like transient times? Mm-hmm. If a band did come back, it wasn't like they were ready. It wasn't like people were ready.
Right. I don't know, you know? I had been so removed by that point.
Right.
I mean, no, maybe not. I mean, I was still doing Abilene, but, you know, it was mainly, like, small one-week tours and, right. you know, local gigs. But and we weren't playing, like, really, really big shows. So I guess, I don't know if I felt like I was disconnected with the guys. Or with the show, or all of it in general, you know.
Do you think that just
also,
happens?
Also, my son was about to be born, so I might have had a full-on weird disconnect. Like, right. what am I doing? Why am I still doing this kid game thing? I got to be a dad.
Right.
What am I doing? You know. Although I don't believe that way anymore. I mean, my son. Like interviews me all the time about all this stuff.
Really?
Like, yeah, he's fully in. I mean, he didn't like all of it, but
does he understand it?
Yeah, he's fascinated by it. It's also the most brilliant human I've ever met. I can't believe it came from me.
That's beautiful. I mean, to have him be interested.
Yeah, it's cool. He was talking to me the other day. Oh, it's red.
What did he say?
No, he's just asking, like, so when you were in Hoover, like, how did it feel? And I'm like, I don't know. How do you feel right now? What do you mean? He's like, but people still ask you about it. And I'm like, yeah, it's wild. And he's like, yeah, that's crazy. How is that after, what, 30?
What, 92?
20.
I'm not good at math.
28 years?
28 years. There we go.
28 years? Jesus Christ.
I think it's also that you're still around to talk about it. You know, these things are, people do, you know, there's things that happen. There's
you know
people
what's
that
surprising
aren't here
to me, though, is how fast everything moves now and the attention spans. That. And then we're talking about this. You think all this shit would disappear. You know? Like, who cares? What's the next thing? Wow, where's the next Starbucks? You right. know, like, whatever. I that's what blows me away about it. Because we're so not connected. But we're so connected. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That how do people still remember this stuff? Or even, when a young cat comes up to you and, like, your band... changed my life. I'm like, you never saw us play.
Right.
You know, like, I was like, fuck the records, man. If you never saw us play, and you never got it. You right. didn't get the real
right.
thing, you know? Because, I mean, at the end of every single one, we were absolutely, everything was left there. If we didn't do that, we felt like we cheated everything. Cheated ourselves, cheated the people that paid to get in, cheated the people that gave us a place to play. Cheated if we didn't leave it all of it out, like pulling your soul out of your mouth and leaving it on the floor. That's how we did it every night. That's the way it's supposed to be done.
That's perfect. Anything else you want to mention?
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for taking time out of your
sure.
New York.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, what else am I going to do? I'm going to go drink some beers now, but...